don't have a lot of awareness on this issue up here. None of even the old hunters have never seen it before.
A strange substance in the Arctic Ocean perplexes North Slope residents. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 14th of July. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a slow tourist season hurts retailers.
The dollars are just not coming out of the wallet. And we're experiencing that here. No matter how strong our tour is, we're capturing less dollars per person.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The Coast Guard is working with the North Slope Borough to identify an unusual substance floating off Alaska's northern coast between Barrow and Wainwright. Test results are still pending, but officials who gathered samples of the material say it isn't petroleum-based. Terry Hasenauer is coordinating the Coast Guard response. He says pollution investigators and a biologist visited the scene.
Based off of their professional experience, they've determined that it was not an oil product of any type. But beyond that, they weren't able to ascertain exactly or to determine exactly what it was. It's suspected that it's some sort of an algae or a naturally occurring marine organism.
A Wainwright resident reported the mysterious dark sheen to the Coast Guard late last week. Bob Shears says he was hearing stories from seal hunters about what looked like oil in a wide strip that stretched for at least 40 miles, 5 miles offshore.
It was a gray, dark gray, goopy substance that was kind of sticky, and it was quite large, about 100 foot wide. And reported to be almost continuous along our Chukchi coastline off of Wainwright. The photographs, the digital photographs that were coming back, showed that it was adhering to the ice, kind of oozing and gooing off the ice. Looked very similar to oil in what my limited experience told me.
Shears says the Coast Guard responded very quickly to the concern. He says biologists have told him the substance could be a highly degraded form of red tide algae.
Don't have a lot of awareness on this issue up here. None of even the old hunters have never seen it before.
Red tide can be harmful to fish, birds, and marine mammals. It is especially toxic to shellfish, which is a primary food source for seals and other wildlife favored by subsistence hunters on the North Slope. The test results are due back next week. The state stopped two fast-moving new wildfires in the interior late yesterday as hot, dry, windy conditions prevailed across the region. One of the blazes at Healy Lake between Delta Junction and Tok off the Alaska Highway threatened homes and cabins. Fire operations forester Tom Kurth says water and retardant dropping aircraft were used to knock down the flames.
We're fortunate that we had four water scooping aircraft, CL-215s, combined with one of our retardant ships, were able to hold that fire at about 125 acres.
Kurth says ground crews are on scene firming up fire lines. 68 fires are burning around Alaska at last count. The Shanta Creek fire within the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge is moving to the east, and Fire Information Officer Mike Ferris says cooler, damp weather is helping keep the fire away from residences to the north and west.
We've been dropping quite a bit of water on the western and northern head of the fire to cool it down. Those are the two sides of the fire that had the greatest potential to threaten life and property because they're pointed towards the Funny River Road area in Sedona. But the weather's kind of mitigated. The winds haven't really been as strong and gusty. We've been getting a really cold marine push every day for the last few days where we wake up and it was really cloudy and foggy from the marine moisture that comes in at the night. So it's been kind of in a holding pattern. And given that, we're taking advantage of that. We see that window open and we're going to go for it.
About 500 personnel are fighting the fire. He says hotshot crews were flown to the fire's edge today.
until they can get the whole western flank of the fire in a state where that we feel comfortable that it won't break out of there. And then they're going to turn the corner and go north and try to get that north piece done also.
Crews fighting the Shanta Creek fire are from both Alaska and the lower 48, and they are living in a temporary camp set up around and in Skyview High School in Soldotna. KDLL's Ben Stanton stopped by the incident command post and files this report.
Hundreds of tents scatter the grounds at the high school. Yellow buses for transporting crews are parked in a line. A few larger tents for planning and coordination workers are set up in the parking lot. Near the school building, I talk with spokesman Mike Ferris from Oregon. He travels as part of the National Incident Management Organization.
You know, I can't tell you how appreciative we are to have this facility because generally we're just out in an empty field somewhere, and we bring in all the equipment, all the tents. We have to figure out how to get power to it. We have to bring in either work trailers or we work out of yurts. But, you know, you have to create a workspace because this is what we call our incident command post.
Ferris calls the setup a small city at Skyview. Offices, computers, medical room, purchasing department, internet and technology, and maps are all set up inside.
The firefighters are actually doing the real work on the ground, but somebody's got to support them and feed them and house them and provide showers for them and give them a plan every day to do and brief them and make sure that they're safe.
Ferris says the firefighters and support crews are used to living in tents. It comes as part of the job. Out in the area by the fire, the first of several types of crews that respond are the hotshot crews. Those are 20-person crews on the front lines of firefighting.
They're best trained, best qualified, most experienced, best physically fit. When you see these guys and women, and generally they're big, they're strong, and we put them, because of their capability, we'll put them in the most challenging places on the fire.
Those hotshot crews have other crews then that do important follow-up work. The Type 2 crew follows behind.
So if we got a Type 1 crew, a hotshot crew, that we know we need to cut some serious line in, they'll do that. They'll cut the line and get it kind of scratched out or at least brushed out, and then the Type 2 crew will come by and what we call dress it up and just make sure that it's finished.
Inside Skyview, Ferris points out some of the stations for briefing workers, and we walk into the medical response room where workers say they see a lot of ankle injuries. But there are a variety of ailments. They say at times it is very busy. When we walk in, Waylon Blackweasel is sitting holding crutches and getting attention. Blackweasel looks like Ferris's description of a hotshot crew member, which he has been for about 4 years. His crew is based out of Montana. He injured his back and a nerve moving tools in the first day.
When you're getting dispatched and we hit the fire, sometimes we go automatically go to the fire and start digging iron. Start putting it out right away, you know. That's a lot of work, hard work.
He says it is also dangerous work. During firefighting in Arizona, a member of Blackweasel's crew was killed when the medical transport helicopter he was in collided with another helicopter. But he says that sort of incident does not deter him. He enjoys the job and the work. He says it can be challenging, especially when crews are dropped out in the middle of a forest and don't come back to base camp for days. It's called spiking out. His crew did that in Idaho a few years ago.
And they spiked us out for 11 days, so he's like in a forest for like, you're just out in a forest and you're there, you know, for the duration, the time they want you there, you know.
Hotshot crew members like Blackweasel use a lot of energy to fight fires, and Ferris says that work means about a 7,000 calorie a day diet. The workers are fed in the high school cafeteria by cooks and kitchen managers. Ferris says that the public generally understands most of what fire crews and support staff are going through.
They know people are putting their lives on their lines to protect their properties. And it's not just their lives. I mean, it's as simple as an injury like poor Waylon had, you know, hurting his back. And he's going to be miserable for a couple of weeks. And he'll probably be off work.
Ferris says the systems and methods for both fighting fires and supporting those workers have been developed. And the ultimate goal is safety of workers and the public. In Soldotna, I'm Ben Stanton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, new photo collections join an online archive of Native history.
Understanding their history and heritage helps people understand who they are and the heritage they come from.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The state's Division of Senior and Disability Services has begun work to overcome a federal order removing its authority to accept new applications for personal care assistance and for programs offering help to people needing waivers to be able to receive Medicaid services. But Division Director Rebecca Hilgendorf says she doesn't know how long it will take to make the improvements necessary after a recent federal review. The review by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services found the state management to be out of compliance with federal standards in all aspects of the programs. Department of Health and Human Services spokesperson Terry Compton said the federal review had been planned for later this year but got accelerated attention after reports surfaced of a backlog of more than 2,000 assessments of people requesting services in Alaska. The review noted that during a 2.5-year span, 27 people had died while waiting for initial assessments, and another 200 had died waiting for reassessments due to changing needs. Hilgendorf says those results concerned the division, too, and she recognizes the need for improvement.
The people who receive our services are the frail and elderly, people who have multiple disease processes occurring in their lives, and that there's that natural client death to occur as people are receiving services.
And Marcy Rhine, the chief of programs at the division, said they have a process to try to avoid complications.
Acknowledging that we have a backlog, we also have a process to triage those awaiting for an assessment so that there's a process for us to expedite an assessment if there appears to be a change in condition. If somebody's health is declining or their needs have significantly changed, we can move them to the front of the line, so to speak, in order to accommodate and make sure that we're addressing those changing needs.
Hilgendorf says the $250 million state and federal program is sufficiently funded, but has had trouble hiring qualified people to work in the system. Her biggest need to reduce the backlog is nurses who can perform the assessments of new applicants, usually a 90-day process. With a 40% vacancy rate, she said, the state is increasing its efforts to recruit people for the jobs. She says they are also expanding the job description to allow social workers or health care management professionals to perform the assessments. Hilgendorf began work as division director in December of last year. The federal report determined that the problems began in 2006 when the legislature included non-binding language in the budget calling for steps that could reduce state spending on the program and could prevent suspected misuse of the system. From jewelry shop owners to tour operators, Ketchikan's cruise ship industry appears to be suffering the effects of a weakened global economy. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, industry officials say they expected a downturn in sales this season. While some have been pleasantly surprised, others say they had no way of planning for the drop in sales they're seeing this summer.
Last season was very slow, and we was thinking this season going to be slow, but not like this.
It's bad.
It's very, very bad.
That's Abdu Asik from Asik Jewelers in downtown Ketchikan. Asik is standing in an empty store and polishing a large diamond ring as he talks about his decline in business this summer.
Compared to last season, it's dropped off at least 65 to 70% of drop off. And even last season, compared to the season before, it's dropped off like 50 to 45% off.
This is Asik's ninth year selling jewelry in Ketchikan. He says he's never seen sales so bad, even when there were far fewer cruise ship passengers visiting the region. Scanlan Gallery owner Susan Peters says she had expected a downturn this summer, and so far that's what she's seen.
People are still hesitating, not, spending what they would. They may be traveling, but they're not, buying for themselves or others as much.
Like Asik, Peter says less expensive items account for most of her sales this summer. Down the street at Exploration Gallery, owner Diane Nabb says she's seeing less customers walk through her doors. Those who do are spending more money.
We're all creatures of habit, and if you got a cheap cruise ticket, you're going to spend money on nice items when you get to town. So I'm finding people are still spending.
To make up for the decline in customers, Nabb says she's cut her summer staff. Craig Carson is part owner in several curio and T-shirt shops in downtown Ketchikan. He says his customers are spending less. There is, however, one bright spot this season for most retailers.
Sales have been soft, but maybe not as soft as they could be. We really appreciate having all the good weather. I don't know who there is to thank for that, but the good weather's made a big difference in getting the passengers off the ship and getting them in the stores.
Carson says a majority of his customers are looking for sale and promotional items this summer. Ketchikan Visitors Bureau Executive Director Patty Mackey says higher-end businesses appear to be taking the biggest hit this summer.
You could probably say that the more high-end tours and purchases that people might be making are probably on the slow side, with people looking for more bargains and not to spend as much money.
Now you're going to see a true artist at work.
Over at the Great Alaska Lumberjack Show, the bleachers are packed. Excursions offered by the company run anywhere from $40 to $80 a person. Owner Rob Shear says he expects that most tourism-related companies are going to see a drop in business this summer.
We at the Great Alaska Lumberjack Show are experiencing a net in our tourism side, the show side, but our, you know, the volume in retail is down much more than that. The retail, no matter how we fortify it, if we put in cheaper goods or whatever, the retail, the dollars are just not coming out of the wallet. And we're experiencing that here, no matter how strong our tour is. We're capturing less dollars per person.
With passenger numbers expected to decline again next summer, Shear says he expects some tour companies will be forced to close. Norwegian Cruise Lines, Holland America Line, Royal Caribbean, Cruise West, and Princess have all announced that they're either pulling ships out of or reducing port calls to Ketchikan next summer. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Home sales have been picking up in the Fairbanks area in recent months. The latest data released by the Greater Fairbanks Board of Realtors shows sales more in line with pre-recessionary numbers. The board's Kirk Maynard says demand appears to have rebounded.
In Fairbanks, we went from last month having roughly 5 to 8 months worth of inventory for $300,000 and down to 3 months worth of inventory. It's the first time we've seen a seller's market in Fairbanks for under 300 in 2 years. So very favorable for sellers in that market. In North Pole, same trends is continuing. The months remaining inventory went from 8 months average on all price ranges down to 6 months. 6 months is the National Association of Realtors considers a balanced market, and it's the first time we've seen a balanced market in North Pole in 2 years.
Maynard says the market is softer for homes in the $300,000 plus range. He says things seem to be trending in the right direction despite the drawn-out recession. Maynard says financing options are opening up through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation for buyers who can't qualify through a bank.
Alaska Housing has been out of the game. They could not compete with the Fed and their rates. However, as people have been refinancing out of those Alaska Housing loans, they've had more liquidity, and they're taking that and reinvesting and driving down their interest rates. So as of this last week, they are competitive with conventional financing.
Maynard says first-time home buyer credits and the state's energy rebate upgrade program have also been stimulating the market. While sales of existing homes have been on the rise, Maynard says speculative building is still on hold due to financing issues.
Spec building has, you know, been to a halt for the last year, year and a half. I know there's builders out there now wondering if, now that we're in a balanced market in North Pole and in Fairbanks, you know, 250 and down is pretty hot. They're starting to wonder if they should get back into building. So I think banks are going to be still a little bit reluctant to start opening the doors to spec building.
Big questions in the Fairbanks housing market revolve around military construction and troop movements. New post housing, the return of troops from Iraq, and the proposed stationing of a 700 soldier aviation unit at Fort Wainwright could have major impacts on the area real estate market.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. And by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
A light plane crashed in Wasilla this morning, killing the plane's pilot and one passenger. The plane, equipped with floats, took off from Kalmbach Lake and crashed around 10 a.m., according to Alaska State Troopers spokeswoman Megan Peters. Peters says little is known at this time as to the cause of the crash or the plane's occupants.
I mean, we do have NTSB investigators on scene. We have troopers on scene. Right now, we're just trying to figure out what happened, just like everybody else is, and we're trying to contact people who can help us identify who these people are and going from there.
Troopers are waiting on a positive identification of the two victims. The plane crashed near mile 46 of the park's highway and burned on impact. More of Southeast Alaska's native history is going online. That's because two new collections have been added to the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's photographic archives. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Longtime Juneau photographer Brian Wallace contributed several hundred images documenting some of the history of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood. Wallace made the donation in memory of his late parents, ANB and ANS leaders Dorothy and Amos Wallace. They collected or took some of the photos.
You can just see my mom and dad as, you know, young men and women, and my grandparents. Photos from the dedication of the Brotherhood Bridge, groundbreaking for the current Alaska Native Brotherhood building. There's so many, you know, but I just love seeing the photos of my mom and dad and my aunts and uncles as young men in their 50s, and Walter Soboloff when he was just a young man of 70.
The more recent images in the collection include Brotherhood and Sisterhood meetings and events taken by the younger Wallace. Sea Alaska Heritage Institute also recently purchased a set of historic images from the 1880s to the 1940s. Archivist Zachary Jones says they came from Alaska Heritage Bookshop owner Dick Wood of Juneau.
Pretty significant to the Tlingit and Haida Simpson people because they document certain aspects of culture that are rarely captured in photographs. And there's one that shows traditional regalia displayed alongside American military uniforms. There is one particularly nice view of a Haida village taken in 1883 that shows a church bell. It demonstrates how Christianity was meeting with traditional culture in a rather interesting, perhaps complex way.
The new collections join other digital images that include historical scenes and more recent events. They include black and white and color photos depicting village life, potlatches, and cultural festivals.
We do this to document and sort of help people understand their history, because understanding their history and heritage helps people understand who they are and the heritage they come from.
Other photos in the Institute's archives come from architect Lynn Forrest, authors Richard and Nora Marks Downhauer, and even some stereo images bought on eBay. Juneau photographer Brian Wallace says he's particularly happy to contribute to the collection.
The digital age is really opening up doors for getting a second life for a lot of these images. Rather than sit away in some drawer and turn to yellow and fade away, I'm glad that Sea Alaska Heritage Institute will take these in, take care of them, and make them available for historians.
The photographic archive can be viewed online through the Institute's website, www.sealaskaheritage.org. It's also available on Google's Picasso website under the Sea Alaska Heritage Gallery. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Sailors like adventures, but some want adventures with a greater purpose. Another sailboat passed through Unalaska recently to attempt the Northwest Passage. This time, the crew of the 40-foot sailboat want to educate people about climate change in the Arctic. KUCB's Ann Hillman spoke with the skipper.
Captain Cameron Duick sat in a bar in Unalaska, his face scruffy and worn. He had spent most of the day at the same table using the free wireless internet and editing pictures and text. He and his crew had just completed the first month of their four-month voyage from Victoria, Canada to Halifax via the Northwest Passage.
We want to sail the Silent Sound through the Northwest Passage, west to east. And while we're doing that, we want to learn more about how climate change is impacting communities in the Arctic and then retell that story. Via a film documentary. I plan to write a book when I get back. We're doing photography, various forms of sort of artistic communication.
He plans on using connections made through one of his sponsors, a Canadian Arctic airline, to gather people's stories and talk about wider issues associated with climate change, like sovereignty, resource management, and politics in northern Canada.
Obviously, yeah, we'll be recording and stuff, but we edit it and package it and I guess in a way polish it and make it presentable as a in an art sense, but also in a commercial sense. I mean,
he wants to make enough money off of the book and movie to recoup some of the almost $220,000 spent on the primarily self-financed journey. Neither he nor any of the members of his crew have been to the Arctic before, but Duke says their varied international backgrounds give them the sensitivity to approach the project with open minds. His crew includes an American and two Germans. He himself is a Canadian journalist based out of Hong Kong who used to submit travel pieces to the Financial Times. He says he's also reported on oil exploration and trade. The other members of the team include a videographer and a photographer who also has medical training. The crew of the 40-foot fiberglass Silent Sound are also working to make their journey mostly carbon neutral through their sponsor, Texas-based Direct Energy.
So what they have done is they've just bought extra carbon credits based on our estimated fuel consumption on the flights of the crew in and out, all these sort of things. And in order to, we sort of estimated our carbon output, and then they bought credits for that amount.
As the crew wanders through town, they all wear matching shirts with their sponsors' names, logos surrounding their website. Another component of the expedition is psychological. All four crew members are filling out daily and weekly mental health surveys for a university in Germany. The researchers want to determine how living in cramped quarters in the ocean in cold weather for a long period of time affects the crew's moods.
So if there's a nutter on board, we'll find him quick.
35-year-old Duick says mental health might also be strained by the amount of work. With only four crew members, each has long shifts guiding the hand-helmed yacht. One of the original crew already left the expedition after learning that she easily became seasick and didn't like the sailing life. You can follow the team's progress at www.openpassageexpedition.com. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Ben Stanton in Kenai, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.